Justice Patterson will continue with this case. She is not online right now, but she will be reviewing the tape of the recording. Mr. Shalom, please go ahead.
Thank you, and may it please the court. Chief Justice Ravner, you started early on in this argument by clarifying that while the ACLU sets forth lines to draw, should this court consider non-volitional conduct like being removed from the country by immigration officials, that is our fallback position. And indeed, our primary position is that the appellate division got it right in interpreting the Criminal Justice Reform Act to hold that it is designed to measure volitional behavior by defendants in terms of non-appearance, as we're dealing with here. With that said, though it is our primary position, because we believe that the appellate division's reasoning is sound, because Ms. Lehrer set forth many of the arguments we were going to make, I will be very brief on that and then focus on that fallback argument. But let me just say a couple kind of framing questions on that. Mr. Heinzel, when he was up, talked about the kind of primary purpose of the Criminal Justice Reform Act being able to detain people to prevent whether it's non-appearance or harm to the public safety, but that's actually not the primary purpose, and we don't have to take my word for it. The Act is very clear in Chapter 15 that the primary purpose is to release people. The primary purpose is a liberty-respecting one, and that's how the courts and have been told to interpret the statute, with liberty as kind of at the forefront. That doesn't mean that detention isn't a possibility. Of course, everyone would have to acknowledge that, but it is the exception rather than the rule, and that is both a constitutional mandate and set forth very clearly in our statute. I also want to just quickly note, because the Attorney General made a lot of hay of the difference between the Federal Bail Reform Act and the New Jersey Criminal Justice Reform Act with respect to the discussion of flight in the former that doesn't exist in the latter. But actually, it only kind of talks about flight. In subsection E of 1342, it says the government may move for detention in non-enumerated crimes when there is an increased unbearable risk of flight, as can happen here. We have enumerated crimes and we provide a catch-all to prosecutors. But then in subsection E, which talks about how judges should make the decision, it tells judges that what they are looking to measure in that thing is that there is no condition or combination of conditions that will reasonably assure the appearance of persons as required, which is very similar to the language used in our statute to determine whether someone should be detained or shouldn't be detained. I'm happy to answer questions, let me say one more thing on this piece, which is, Chief Justice Ravner, you asked astutely whether this is something that we should defer to the legislature or something that the judiciary needs to take up in the first instance. And I want to say, in some ways, the answer is yes to both questions, because ultimately, if the court is going to interpret the statute as it thinks is most faithful to the legislature's intent, if the court is wrong, the legislature can intercede. But we need a status quo for the court to tell us is right or wrong, right? So either we're going to say the appellate division is right, and if a legislature disagrees and says, no, we meant to reach non-volitional activity, they can do that. Or the court will say the appellate division was incorrect, and we can consider non-volitional conduct, in which case the legislature can again intercede. But we need something in the interstitial period before the legislature acts. And I think the thing that is most faithful to the intent of the legislature, and we have all the both intrinsic and extrinsic evidence to support that, is to affirm the appellate division's decision with respect to volitionality. Last point on volitionality, there seems to be a conflict between two arguments that the state is making. On the one hand, they say, listen, the language of the statute is clear, and it has to mean we can include any sort of non-volitional act possible. And then they say, but of course, we're only really talking. We really only want this narrow exception for immigration status. Those two things don't work together as a matter of statutory interpretation. Either the statute is clear that you can consider non-volitional conduct, or it's not. But if you can consider all non-volitional conduct, then I think the hypothetical that Ms. Lehrer gave you, which is not at all hypothetical, but instead the one of the chief critics of the Criminal Justice Reform Act, lamenting the fact that people had been killed because they had been released under the CJRA. It's not apocryphal. This was before the court made amendments to the decision-making framework with respect to guns. And it was Mayor Steve Fulop. It was also some police chiefs in major cities. So I appreciate my friend Mr. Heinzel's concession that the executive branch would never do that, but members of the executive branch have proposed to do just that. And so we have this very small number of cases impacted by the immigration exception. And my friend Ms. Hunt talked about three or four in the last couple of months. There have been cited in the record another three or four over the last couple of years. It's not that frequent. And I think actually, Justice Albin, this goes to something important from your earliest inquiry, which is when you were talking about the absurd results, the hypothetical you gave was someone who was charged with 10 different counts of aggravated sexual assault against a child. But keep in mind here, we are talking, this rule we are contemplating is only for people who will not be detained because of their risk to public safety, where the only risk that the state can come forward with is a non-volitional risk that the person will be removed from the country. So your hypothetical defendant is out of play because that person is going to get detained.
Not necessarily. Look, there are plenty of, but you stated at the beginning, the presumption, even for sexual offenses, is release. There are plenty of people who have committed sexual offenses who are released, and the victims of those sexual offenses under the Victims' Rights Act, the constitutional amendment, they expect that those people will be brought to justice within this state and not released to another country where they would be able to elude the hand of the state.
I agree, but you're right that theoretically people can be released and there is a presumption. We also know there are 5,500 people currently detained in New Jersey. For a vast majority of them, there isn't a presumption of detention. So judges have found ways to overcome the presumption of release. And most often it is not in reliance on the risk that another government entity will make the person unavailable for trial. So this isn't, Justice Albin, to be clear, to suggest that there isn't a compelling government interest in ensuring that people show up for trial. There, of course, is. It's that the mechanism of detaining many people to, in the rare cases, ensure that these people, that some small subset will show up, is a risky gambit. But let me transition to our fallback position, because I do think where the court draws the line, and ultimately that's what this secondary question is, it's a line drawing question, is going to be absolutely critical to how things go. And I want to applaud my friends from the prosecutor's office for the concessions that they made, because I think, as Ms. Lehrer said, we actually do have a lot of common ground on the test. And so I think there's some things around the margins that the court is going to need to struggle with, and I'll try and help you. But I do think we've made some concessions. So everyone agrees, perhaps with the exception of the Attorney General, that a final order is a necessary prerequisite. Let me just say a quick word on the Attorney General's, I think, red herring about expedited removal. Expedited removal still requires an order. And so the rule proposed by everyone that says we need a final order applies in every single case. People are not getting removed from this country without an order. That's it. Okay, next point is with no pending appeals or collateral challenges. This is again in both the prosecutors and the public defenders test. I think that's right. I just want to say a word about the mechanics of it, because I do think it's important. And we have two different procedural postures in these two sets of cases. And so I think what we need to, in the first instance, what the state would be required to do in a motion to reopen, which is where I think we would most often be litigating these, is to say, we've heard from ICE, and ICE tells us that this order is final, that there are no pending appeals. I think that is the kind of necessary threshold for the state to surmount. However, the state might not know about all collateral challenges, nor could they know about all collateral challenges. And I think it would be fair for the court to assign to defense counsel the burden of coming forward to say, wait, the prosecutor is correct. We have no pending appeals, but we did just file a habeas in the District of New Jersey. That the onus would be on defense counsel, criminal defense counsel, to consult with immigration counsel, where there is one, to find out whether any of those matters had been filed. That is the sort of thing that can happen in an adversarial system like our Criminal Justice Reform Act allows for. Okay.
Can I ask you a question about that?
Of course.
So assume that the habeas has been filed, but ICE says that the defendant is going to be removed on the Monday plane. And that's what they're saying. I don't care what's been filed, we're removing him on Monday.
Well, so typically there are stays issued by federal courts as they determine, hey, so that it will, it's not the act of filing, it's the act of a stay being issued by the federal court. And so if ICE says they're going to remove him no matter what, then they can take that up with the district.
Okay, your point included a stay by the court. Okay.
That's right. So that's that. Travel documents, I think Ms. Lehr, the point she made is critically important here. There had been, I think, some misunderstanding in the papers about what do we mean by travel documents? Because travel documents are not something that is always affirmatively obtained by ICE. It is not a plane ticket. It is instead a passport and a visa. So there are some people who are going to get removed who came in with valid travel documents from their country, who still have valid travel documents from their country that might be in ICE's possession. And so, it's an important thing. It's a necessary thing for them to have travel documents, but it is not a sufficient thing. In footnote 6 of our brief, we cite to three high profile cases, two of which were class actions, of people who are here in the United States, have final orders of removal, and have been living under orders of supervision, in some cases for decades. In both of the classes there, so one was the case of Ravi Ragbir, who's an immigration advocate from New Jersey and New York, and the other are cases in the District of New Jersey and in the District of Michigan, one of the districts of Michigan, which are both classes. And in both of those classes, there were several people who had both final orders and travel documents. Those cases, incidentally, were from 2017, and all of the impacted people are still living in this country with both, I assume, still travel documents, but still final orders. And so if what we're trying to identify is imminence and certainty, I think it's important to remember that travel documents are necessary, but not sufficient, because many people will have travel documents who will not be soon to get on a plane. I think effort, for lack of a better word, some effort by the prosecutor to forestall removal is not just required because it makes good policy sense. I think it is absolutely required by the very language of the CJRA, because the CJRA is all about where the bad things, in this case, non-appearance, cannot be prevented by lesser interventions like conditions. So to say you don't even have to try is really to excuse things we would never excuse. Let me give you a parallel hypothetical. Imagine that the concern in the case was that the defendant lived in close proximity to the victim. This was something that the state raised in Mulcher and Rios. Let's say this is a defendant who is going to get released otherwise, but he has no place to live other than next door to the victim. If the judge was concerned with that, and it came to the court's attention that there was a shelter at the other side of town, and the defendant could live there, but all we needed to do to have the defendant live there was the prosecutor to make the request. We would say, well, that's a condition that you have to check before we could authorize detention, because it's a less restrictive alternative. And so the question is, are we making them make that request for the shelter, which in this case is to ICE? And everyone seems to agree that asking them to do something and have ICE come back and say no dice is a necessary prerequisite. And the question is, what do they have to say? And I think it's important to flesh out what defense counsel Ms. Lehrer requested. She said they have to make the request, they have to cite the authority, and they have to apply the facts to it. That is not an onerous demand. So we've heard a lot today, or we've heard some today, about parole under 8 U.S.C. 1182D. And we've heard that parole can be granted, and I suspect we'll hear more from Professor Gottesman in a moment, that parole can be granted when there is a significant public benefit, and that ICE has granted parole when the significant public benefit is seeing a defendant brought to justice to face charges. So what it would require in a case like one of these is saying, please release the defendant on parole. You have the authority to do that pursuant to 8 U.S.C. 1182D. In this case, the significant public benefit that would inure would be the following. We would get to, these are serious charges and they're victims whose interests are implicated. And he would be released on the following conditions. We are proposing 24-hour home detention with electronic monitoring. Those are the things that would be required. And if ICE wrote back to that and said, I hear you, prosecutor, but go kick rocks, then the state would have satisfied their burden of—
I want to understand something. You want the prosecutor to tell the ICE officials who have someone in custody who at some point they intend to remove, to release the person on parole? You're putting that obligation on the prosecutor? ICE people, I know you got someone in custody there. What I'd really like you to do is release the person on parole. Like, why should they have that obligation? I don't understand that.
Because it's a condition of release. So Justice Alvin, they don't have to do that, but they are asking to use the mechanism of our criminal court to detain a person instead.
No, right? What this is what I heard, I think, Mr. Heintzel say. The person basically has to have a final order. The person has to be in custody. The person has to have his travel documents. And there's a communication between the prosecutor and ICE. And ICE is saying that if your court does not issue that detention order, the person's going to be on the plane and out of the country. Now, is that not certain and imminent enough?
It is not, but let me be real specific. I have a list of seven factors and I was on four and you hit five, but let's just knock it out because I do think there's widespread agreement. Custody. Custody is a prerequisite for it not to be, it both implicates all sorts of bad incentives, but also really reflects that we're not talking about imminence. And so as I think Mr. Heintzel conceded, though I think the Attorney General equivocated, it should be explicit in the test that custody is a prerequisite. Assuming that is so, Justice Alvin, Mr. Heintzel is shaking his head, and if I put words in his mouth, he has rebuttal, and I apologize. I was not trying to, Mr. Heintzel, I assure you. But I do think, whether or not Mr. Heintzel concedes it, I think custody is an explicit requirement, and it must be because ICE is not putting anyone on a plane without first putting them in custody. And so I think for all that we have as a countervailing interest is this very speculative assertion that it is theoretically possible that ICE will arrest someone, put them into custody, and put them on a plane without sufficient time for the state to seek a motion to reopen and produce the defendant. I don't think there's any evidence to support that that practice is widespread or even has ever happened, that someone gets detained and removed that quickly. But let me just circle back to the question on effort. You've agreed that they have to reach out to ICE and ICE has to tell them there's nothing we can do. And so all we're suggesting is they have to say, here's one more tool in your toolbox, ICE. And if you were to use this tool, this is how it would play out. And this is how it would be beneficial to us. Again, Justice Alvin, remember, if this is a person who could be detained under the CJRA for other reasons, who should otherwise be detained because of risks to public safety, then they get detained for those reasons. We're talking about this small subset where detention is only premised or only gets over the threshold because of this risk of non-appearance. So the idea that we would release that person is not so crazy. In fact, it's necessary to the argument that the judge would have found that this person under the CJRA is appropriate for release, but for the risk of non-appearance occasioned by ICE's behavior. So that is exactly what I'm suggesting, to just be very clear.
Mr. Shalom, on that last point, you acknowledged that it's this request to go to ICE and get the person out of custody in order to make the application raises for me the question that I have in mind. the state, I don't think, is taking the position, maybe they are, and maybe you're responding to it, that going to the judge and asking for detention because ICE removal is imminent, whether the person's in custody or not, is a foregone conclusion that the court, the state court, must detain the individual. It's still simply a consideration, correct?
You're getting to my seventh consideration, but I'll hop right there, Justice LeVec.
Okay, because I'm trying to understand. You want the state, you're suggesting the state goes and gets the person out of ICE custody in order to present them to the state court that still has the discretion to decide whether or not to detain at all.
No, so I think there has been no disagreement amongst anyone that ICE will make defendants available for detention hearings while they're in ICE custody. So there's no doubt but that they will do that, I think. And again, my able adversaries can disagree, but I don't think that has ever been the question. There's been questioned about how much time. I believe Mr. Heinzel said that they typically request 48 hours, but not that they don't make people available while they're in the Essex County Jail, the ICE side.
Okay. What I'm getting at is the state's decision to pursue this application with ICE and to bring this argument to the trial court is not converting the state's position to one where it has become the decision maker for detention.
That is correct. That is, of course, correct. So let me actually skip down to number seven, which is not, I'm not sure if it's a prerequisite, but there's been some confusion, at least in my head, on positions that were taken by Ms. Anton, which is, on the one hand, she said, look, we would never seek this for the non-serious charges. We're only seeking it in very serious cases. On the other hand, said, if our test is met where we have a final order and no appeals and travel documents, then it would be an abuse of discretion for the judge not to detain that person. That can't be so, because that suggests that there's no ability for the judge to say, I find that the interests in liberty don't outweigh the interests in detention. And so it's true, they're rarely moving for detention in shoplifting cases. But if they do, and we've created a rule that says, if you check these boxes, the person must be detained rather than may be detained, then it will presumably change behavior. So I think what I wanna say is, these are threshold questions that are required for the court to consider the non-volitional non-appearance, not that they therefore dictate the court's result.
Then you're going to come to us on some equal protection argument. So we have similarly situated aggravated sexual assault defendants, and all of the prerequisites are made, final order, custody, travel documents, the person is going to be removed on Monday, and one judge is to say, since it's May, I'll bring him into the state's custody to be tried. And in the other case, I don't think so. Let him go back to Guatemala. Do you want to leave that type of discretion in the trial courts?
I do. I don't see how that discretion is any different than two similarly situated robbery defendants who are both citizens presenting exactly the same facts to two different detention judges who get different results. I think the discretion that is a part of the Criminal Justice Reform Act is a feature, not a flaw. And I don't think
How would someone exercise that, given all of those factors? Tell me how that discretion would be exercised other than in some arbitrary way.
There's no victim in this case. It's a fourth degree drug case. No,
I've given you the sexual aggravated sexual assault. Two defendants charged with aggravated sexual assault, and you have all the prerequisites, and the person is going to be on a plane on Monday. And you're saying Judge A can decide to detain the person, and Judge B now.
I think both Judge A and B would detain that person if the guidance from this court allowed them to. I think what I'm kind of barking at in this seventh factor, Justice Albin, is this: the rule proposed by the state makes no exception for minor crimes, for crimes without identifiable victims, where you talked about the sovereign interest in bringing a person to justice. I think that interest is diminished in lower level cases and victimless cases.
Mr. Shalom, doesn't that actually raise the feature of why this is such a Janus argument that we have going on here. Because when you think about the position that is being advocated on behalf of the state, it really, in listening to it this morning, sounds like the person has to be detained by the court. And if that's true, because non-appearance is such a certainty, then we have really rewritten, we would really be rewriting this statute to interpret from the legislature an absolute intention to detain every illegal, every undocumented immigrant who was at that point along the line of being removed from ICE. So it has completely upended what is a very discretionary, individualized assessment that considers a number of features into a lockstep requirement.
I think that's right. And I think it not only is our statute discretionary and multifaceted, but it has its thumb on the scale of liberty.
It does.
And this then puts its thumb on the other side of the scale. So it's not just that it puts its thumb on the scale, but it's where it puts it that is so directly contradictory to the express wishes of the legislature. And again,
well, I'm going to come back to a question that I asked one of your adversaries earlier. I mean, I look at the federal statute. The federal statute, which our legislature did not follow, gave a little timeout period to let ICE decide what they want to do. And then if the person is not proceeded against through the immigration officials, then the person comes back into the system of pretrial detention and gets analyzed on an individualized basis as if that one feature is not part of the equation. That seems to be the logical way to interpret this statute, because otherwise we are imposing an absolute requirement to detain based upon immigration status, listening to the state's argument play out. I'm having trouble, unless you're reading the discretionary part of the court more flexibly, and I'm looking to you because you raised it as a feature, not a flaw. I don't know how it works in this situation, other than to compel a court to have to detain.
I think that's right. I think your reading is correct. I think there's an interesting process point that comes up in the dichotomy between these two cases. So we had Rios and Mulcher come first, and then the appellate division decided Rios and Mulcher, and they said non-volitional stuff can't be considered. Then you had the case come up in Somerset County. And in Somerset County, where the person had originally been released, the state then said, look, now we have a final order, it's a change in circumstances, because we think now we're more likely to face the prospect of this person being removed. And the court said, no, it's not. Now, I want to just unpack that, because I think it's right. The court didn't allow the motion to be reopened. Here's the thing. The court was bound by Rios and Mulcher, which said this has no impact. So the court made clearly the right decision under binding appellate division precedent that said you can't consider this. If that weren't the case, which is kind of the prerequisite for this whole line drawing conversation, then of course it should the case should be reopened. I don't think it should change the result, but it is of course a change in circumstance. And I do think our trial courts need to be more liberal with reopening, right? They should use the standard from Hippolyte of a reasonable possibility, not a reasonable probability of a different result. So if Rios and Mulcher weren't the law, if the Mulcher decision wasn't the law, then I do think the Lopez Carrera court made the wrong choice in not reopening, but it was the law and they were bound by it. So there was really nothing to be said there.
Mr. Shalom, once we meet your standard of imminence and certainty, the question is not between detention or non-detention. The question is whether or not the person will be tried for the crime that has, for which charges have been filed in this state, or the person will be released to another country. And that's the question. So talking about detention and non-detention seems to me to evade that basic point.
Justice Albin, I think fundamentally, and I know that my friend Professor Gottesman will pound this point home, but I think fundamentally that reflects a misunderstanding of the ability of state courts to gauge imminence and certainty.
So look, I'm putting into the equation the ability to actually make that determination. What's that? Unless it's impossible, and I guess we'll hear from Professor Gottesman.
Correct. And so I think what she'll tell you is that it's impossible. What I'm telling you is, if you think it is possible, you need to be real certain of it. And so each of those seven steps along the way are important. Last point that I'll say, because I'm mindful that I've taken a lot of your time, is that the Attorney General kind of eschews the what they call bright line position, the tests that have variously been put forth by the public defender and by the prosecutor's office. And says our kind of more mushy consideration is better. But let's be clear about something. The state wanted Mr. Mulcher and Mr. Rios detained. They argued for their detention under their test. They argued for their detention that the prosecutor now recognizes it was unacceptable, isn't supported by their test. But under the Attorney General's test, Mr. Rios and Mr. Mulcher, who had no final order, weren't even on ICE's radar and have now been out for the last 4 months on level one supervision, would both be detained. So I think, again, our primary position is that the CJRA contemplates only volitional non-appearance for the reasons that we've been discussing all morning. But as a fallback, if the court is going to allow the consideration of non-volitional non-appearance, it needs to make sure that there is a final order, that there are no appeals or collateral challenges to that appeal that would slow things down, that travel documents have been obtained, that the defendant is in custody, that the state has made a sufficient effort to prevent removal using all of the tools available to it, that a ticket has been obtained, and that on balance, the interests in prosecution justify detention. And so that's what I would consider the kind of minor charge or victimless charge exception. Unless the court has any further questions, I appreciate your indulgence.
Thank you, Mr. Shalom. Professor Gottesman.
May it please the court. I would like to address what I see as the three primary flaws of the various tests that have been proposed for measuring risk of removal. And those are the fact that all of the tests require state court judges to make legal determinations involving immigration law that are outside their expertise, and also that require depend on facts that are not easily ascertainable. In addition, the state tests do not adequately take account ICE prosecutorial discretion and both their intent and their ability to deport. And third, I'd like to talk about custody and the importance of custody. But as an initial threshold matter, I do have serious concerns that I feel like I would be remiss for not raising about the extent to which the criminal defense community in New Jersey has the expertise to adequately ensure that their clients' interests are met in these circumstances were the risk of removal to be considered in these detention hearings. And I have a concern that that will undermine one of the goals of the CJRA, which as I understand it was to address some of the high levels of incarceration among low income people of color. And that is of course, because in removal proceedings, non-citizens don't have a right to free counsel. And so it's not a given that all of the individuals that we're talking about are going to have sufficient immigration representation to defend all of their interests. But if I could turn to the flaws that I alluded to at the outset, I think the tests are spoken about as if they are bright line rules. But in fact, I just want to emphasize that they require state court judges to have nuanced understanding of and to make nuanced legal determinations regarding immigration law. So first, they all rely on the existence of a removal order. And I just would like to get at the assumption that sort of there is necessarily a thing out there that is going to be clearly marked, you know, final removal order. And that's just not how it works. It's often a legal determination whether a removal order is final or not. So even with a final removal order, a non-citizen could have been granted withholding of removal or relief under the Convention Against Torture, and there may be no prospect of that person being deported, and that person will have a final removal order. There also may be questions, was that order entered in absentia? Because if so, it could be reopened at any time under 8 U.S.C. section 1229 AB5C. There are also the Attorney General's test talks about expedited removal. And just to give a sense of the kind of nuances that are going to go into an analysis of whether the individual is subject to expedited removal, there's going to be a question of, is it under section 238 that involves certain individuals with certain kinds of convictions of crimes? They're going to have to know, is that crime an aggravated felony? That's a challenge for an immigration judge, let alone a state court judge. Are they subject to expedited removal under section 235 involving individuals who, you know, are at a port of entry or in the United States for less than 2 years? Did that individual enter the United States as an unaccompanied alien child? Because if so, under the Trafficking Victim Protection Act, expedited removal will never apply to them. As I hope you can see, these are not the kind of determinations that I think a state court judge is going to want to wade into. And even with expedited removal, again, withholding of removal that I alluded to, that provides protection to certain individuals who fear certain kinds of harms in their home country, might still apply to them, as is relief under the Convention Against Torture. I also wanted to talk about the kinds of facts that the judges will need to determine whether a removal order is, or the finality of a removal order, or whether there are other challenges. So not even the defendant, him or herself, or their counsel are likely to have a full picture of the immigration history. I think any immigration attorney will tell you that one of the first things they do is they file multiple Freedom of Information Act requests from multiple agencies, CBP, ICE, EOIR, the immigration courts, just to get a sense of their individual's history, because their client, him or herself, may not even know. I also came across an OIG, Office of Inspector General report on ICE deportation operations from 2017 that talks about problems with ICE's own record keeping and its own officers' knowledge of the individual's criminal history and immigration history, and inaccuracies in those records. So I don't think it's a case that, a prosecutor or anyone is going to be able to just contact ICE and find out, what else is happening in this individual's case. Was there a habeas filed, Mr. Shalom, mentioned, that came with an emergency stay? Another thing that could happen is that individual could apply for benefits, affirmative immigration benefits with U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, and that will change the procedural posture of their case if that application is approved. And there are federal courts that might enjoin removal, once USCIS, grants certain benefits from someone who was previously undocumented. So there are multiple types of actions that could interfere with the finality of an order, and it's going to be difficult for courts to ascertain whether those things have happened. The other piece that I alluded to was the role of ICE's own prosecutorial discretion and the manifestation of both their intent to actually execute the order and their ability to do so. So I just would like to get at the assumptions underlying a lot of the conversation we've been having, that there is some kind of direct line between, an individual's apprehension and, then it goes entry of order and getting travel documents. In fact, documents can be obtained at any time, and travel documents can be obtained, and then the individual can be released. And that happens all the time. So I looked at statistics on the Alternative to Detention program. So ICE has an Alternative to Detention program, ATD program. And in 2018 statistics, they had 87,000 individuals in that program. So people who actually have been released. And it indicated that 14% of those had a final order of removal. So people with final orders of removal are released into the community all the time for a variety of reasons, including changing prosecutorial discretion, which changes all the time. There, if you look, there are a variety of memos that have been issued, prosecutorial discretion memos that have been issued and changed under various administrations within the same administration. You know, there is nothing, there is no straight line to removal, but I think it just indicates that it's very important to ascertain whether ICE is actually intending to deport someone, which is why I think that a flight being scheduled is at least some indication that they intend to do so, although it is also not sufficient because, you know, in many cases, there are problems with whether they're going to be able to schedule the flight. Flights are rescheduled. Repatriation agreements with different countries can become an issue. And I believe there was an example that someone gave of that, in fact, happening in one of the cases here. So without knowing, without having some sort of affirmative expression that ICE intends to sort of act on the order, there is no certainty, and certainly there is no imminence of actual removal. I also just wanted to talk about custody. I think it has been implicit in some of the conversations, but I agree with Mr. Shalom and Ms. Lehrer that it really needs to be explicit that custody is part of it, because ICE is not deporting anyone until they have them in their custody. And I think it's instrumental here to also look at the Board of Immigration Appeals and when the Board of Immigration Appeals, the BIA, is willing to entertain requests for emergency stays. That is when the BIA is concerned enough that removal might actually happen, that it feels the need to take some action. And looking at the BIA's standard operating procedures, and which actually were only obtained through a FOIA by the American Immigration Lawyers Association. And there's also a fact sheet regarding emergency stays to the BIA. They talk about custody and a flight scheduled within 1 week as their definition of imminence. And I have to say, they don't use certain, because I don't think any of us, as an immigration practitioner and professor, I wish I had a crystal ball. I wish I could predict. If I were a private attorney, I could probably make a lot of money if I could do that, but this is impossible. And I think it is at least instructive to look to the BIA, which, you know, deals with these situations more than most of us, that, you know, they sort of don't want to be bothered. Don't come to me and say this is going to happen right away unless there's a flight scheduled within a week and unless the person is in custody. And of course, implicit is there is a final order, because they could not be deported without a final order. There is a lot that I could say, but I think the point that I really would like to make is that my concern about if risk of removal is permitted to be considered, you know, will we end up back in a place where we were before the CJRA? And that if this court is committed to issuing a rule, that the rule has to contain prongs that rely on easily ascertainable facts and not on nuanced understanding of immigration law, and, you know, should look to immigration law standards for definitions of when removal is actually imminent or at least highly likely. So I'm happy to answer any questions that your honors may have.
Questions, anyone? Thank you, Professor. Ms. Anton, did you want to offer rebuttal?
Very briefly, Your Honor. I think, just to sum things up, when we're left with the decision that came out from the appellate division in this case, the net result is, as we talked a little bit about earlier, kind of this absurd result, because we're left with a decision that is essentially going to treat citizens and non-citizens differently, in that citizens are going to have to answer to charges, whereas certain non-citizens will not have to answer to those charges. The purpose of detention when it's granted is to assure a defendant's appearance at trial. When we base that on volitional acts, that risk is always speculative. A court is considering that it's always speculative that a person may not appear. This is the one scenario that we're approaching the court when it's not speculative anymore. We know a defendant isn't going to be there. I just can't believe that the CJRA would have anticipated or would have allowed that to be the situation. With respect to volitional non-appearance, you know, the example I think by defense counsel was maybe a defendant just decided to stay home and binge Netflix. We're going to eventually catch up with that person. I can't believe that that was the greater risk when they enacted the CJRA. They were more worried about that circumstance than the circumstance where we may never get that person back in court.
What are you basing that on in light of the objective data that shows that is a much more significant concern in terms of defendants who don't appear in court?
I think it is a much more common concern and much more common occurrence that's the reason they don't appear in court. But the problem is, or not the problem is, but the reality is we're going to eventually catch up with them. Whereas in this situation, even though it is non-volitional conduct, we're going to lose them forever. Short of death, I can't think of any other situation where the risk is 100% as it is here. With non-volitional conduct, there's been some discussion about it being sort of a slippery slope or opening the door to these other arguments. But judges who are deciding detention motions, they use their discretion. They use their discretion in everyday decisions. And with other non-volitional conduct, if someone were to move for detention based on other non-volitional conduct, we would need to consider whether any conditions of release or combination could assure their appearance at trial. The bad neighborhood, the not taking medication, those are all things that can be controlled or monitored by pretrial services on release. This is the one thing that cannot be monitored by pretrial services. This is the one situation. That's kind of the whole point of the state's argument, is that there is just nothing we can do about it.
So is the point of the state, Ms. Anton, so is the point of the state's argument then that you have an absolute right to detention in these categories? Once the prosecutor makes the application, you must receive an order requiring these individuals to be detained.
So, Your Honor,
I don't understand where your argument is going with your certainty that the state will absolutely lose this person forever. It seems to me as if you have taken CJRA out of it and just simply said the legislature must have meant we can hold these people because they're going to be removed, period. That's a different statute.
Yeah, and I completely understand the confusion, and I apologize if I have led to any confusion, but there's always discretion. And under the CJRA, when we initially move for detention, the fact that someone is a non-citizen should not be relied on, absolutely. But over the course of litigation, that may change the detention consideration, in that we are notified by ICE that they are ready to leave the country and be permanently removed from the country. We just want the opportunity to get back in front of the judge. And I mean that sort of like a bright line triggering event to get us back in front of the judge to argue that, look, this is imminent. This is happening. And I do steer away from the certain.
I know that you're framing your response to me in that way, but it's difficult to understand your argument to mean anything other than that this non-appearance is certain and must receive an order of detention?
Well, certainly that would be the state's argument. The defense can always bring in other information if they're aware, as Amiki have described, if they're aware of other situations, there is an appeal that's going to be filed or something like that. That is other information that the defense could bring into it. I'm saying it's a triggering event that we should be able to get in, and the court should be able to consider detention in order to hold that person.
But let's talk about the factors for a second that Professor Gottesman enumerated. And I want to see if you agree with them.
Okay.
A removal order, travel documents, an affirmative expression by ICE that the defendant will be removed, that the defendant is in custody, and that a flight is scheduled. Do you agree that those are all factors that must be present before the judge can enter a detention order?
I do not agree with all of those factors. And here's why and where I disagree a little bit. The in custody thing, I think, and this could be a fundamental misunderstanding on my part, and if it is, I apologize, but I think that it was mentioned that there are instances where somebody may not be in custody, even though the statute says they shall be in custody once they're ready to be removed, that there may be instances where they're not.
Think about this logically. How could anyone be imminently removed if they're not in the custody of ICE?
I agree with you.
So that seems to equate with imminence, that the person is in custody, no?
I do think so, yes. I think that if someone is out on the street, there's a reason they're out on the street. Either they've been given a stay or some other action that in our test would preclude.
So I'm raising this. So why won't you concede custody? If custody is required for imminence, why aren't you giving that up?
The reason I'm hesitant to give that up, Your Honor, is because I just don't know if there's a situation where we get a phone call that says we picked up this person, we are removing them on a flight, tomorrow, and we just don't have the time at that point to get into court and to do something about it. And that's why I just hate to say never. I think in most every case, they will be in custody, but I just want the court to have the ability.
Why should we be setting a rule for your 1 in a million cases then?
I don't think you're setting the rule for that. I just think you can anticipate and incorporate that into the rule. For instance, if you know, look, the investigator for ICE tells you, look, as soon as we pick this person up, we can't find him. As soon as we pick him up, he's going. That should be enough to get you in front of a judge to say, look, they say as soon as they pick him up, he's going. So that's the kind of unique instance I can imagine where we would want the ability to represent to the court, look, this is happening. He may not be in custody right this second, but it's coming and he's going to be on a plane. If something were to happen and he didn't get removed, defendants always can come back into court and bring that fact to light and have a defendant released if necessary. Court always has that discretion. But everyone has talked about how nuanced in immigration law is, and I can foresee a circumstance where a defendant, his removal will come very imminently or quickly, and he may not be in custody at that moment.
Ms. Anton, can I ask you that? Bring your argument to a close quickly.
Sure. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Touch on what you believe you need to, but this is rebuttal.
I'm very sorry. If there are any other questions, otherwise I'm finished.
Thank you. Mr. Heinzel, brief rebuttal?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Just a few points. I would agree. It seems that at this point, there's an awful lot that we agree on as far as like the crafting of a workable test. There may be certain elements at the periphery. But given where we are, and given that the court, I believe, can fashion a reasonable test that will allow our interests to be safeguarded, we're talking about, and then possibly having the legislature re-examine this to see if this is something they want to get back into, I think we should look at what are the relative harms in that interim. We lose the opportunity forever to try these people, whereas what they lose is an ability to be deported without having to face their charges. I think the relative harms are a slam dunk for us. And what we're when we're talking about a relatively small total number of cases vis-a-vis the vast bulk of cases that are affected by bail reform, I'm just a little bit concerned that the legislature may not see this as something that urgently needs to be taken up when the current language of the bill clearly allows for our interpretation, and especially the legislative history that followed. We think the language is clear, but made even more clear still by the fact that the way the bill was changed along the way. As far as theoretical harms versus real harms that Mr. Shalom briefly touched on, Hernando Campos was a first degree aggravated sexual assault case. That case out of, I think it was a DCJ case that recently was mooted out because he was flown out of the country. Niagadu is the defendant's name, also a first degree case. These are very important cases where they're not being detained under the current framework. As far as having to go through certain steps with ICE and having to try and ask them to reconsider their own decisions, I think I would assume that ICE knows their own toolkit and ICE knows what sort of discretionary tools they have at their command. But and when they say to us, there's nothing we can do, that alone should be enough. Let's see, as far as, the one other thing I wanted to mention, because this has been something that's been floated around, is that we have to wait until flight arrangements are actually made. That's, in our experience, not a workable part of the test, because at that point, it's too far along. We've seen from ICE that they tell us typically Thursday or Friday of the week before that, hey, this guy's gonna be on Tuesday's flight out, Tuesday morning. So we're talking like one business day. And the act calls for 3 business days to even schedule a hearing. So if we have to wait for that eventuality, it's going to be too late. And as far as the flight issues mentioned in the Inspector General's report, they weren't really of significant enough sort of moment. I think that was like 1.5% of all final removal orders had flight scheduling delays that brought it beyond the 90-day period. And none of those were released because they got really out of hand as far as the delays. But those are the points I wanted to make, and thank the court for its time.
Thank you, Mr. Heinzel. Thank you to all counsel. Very fine arguments. It's very careful preparation that's helpful to the court. We will take the matter under advisement.